Chapter 4 1 The thing which had been Ellen Carver, taller now, still wearing the badge but not the Sam Brown belt, stood on the steps of the municipal building, staring north along the sand-drifted street, past the dancing blinker light. It couldn't see the movie theater but knew where it was. More, it knew what was going on inside the movie theater. Not all, but enough to anger it. The cougar hadn't been able to shut the drunk up in time, but at least she had drawn the rest of them away from the boy. That would have been fine, except the boy had eluded its other emissary as well, at least temporarily. Where had he gone? It didn't know, couldn't see, and that was the source of its anger and fear. He was the source, David Carver, the goddamned shitting prey boy. It should have killed him when it had been inside the cop and had had the chance. Should have shot him right on the steps of his own damned motorhome and left him for the buzzards. But it hadn't, and it knew why it hadn't. There was a blankness about Master Carver, a shielded quality. That was what had saved little prey boy earlier. Its hands clenched at its sides. The wind gusted, blowing Ellen Carver's short, red-gold hair out like a flag. Why is he even here, someone like him? Is it an accident? Or was he sent? Why are you here? Are you an accident? Were you sent? Such questions were useless. It knew its purpose, ta-ka-la, and that was enough. It closed its Ellen eyes, focusing inward at first, but only for a second. It was unpleasant. This body had already begun to fail. It wasn't a matter of decay so much as intensity. The force inside it, Candelach, heart of the unformed, was literally pounding it to pieces, and its replacements had escaped the pantry. Because of Prey Boy. Shitting Prey Boy. It turned its gaze outward, not wanting to think about the blood trickling down this body's thighs, or the way its throat had begun to throb, or the way that, when it scratched Ellen's head, large clumps of Ellen's red hair had begun to come away under its nails. It sent its gaze into the theater instead. What it saw, it perceived in overlapping, sometimes contradictory images, all fragmentary. It was like watching multiple TV screens reflected in a heap of broken glass. Primarily, the eyes of the infiltrating spiders were what it was looking through, but there were also flies, cockroaches, rats peering out of holes in the plaster, and bats hanging from the auditorium's high ceiling. These latter were projecting strange, cool images that were actually echoes. It saw the man from the truck, the one who had come into town on his own, and his skinny little girlfriend leading the others back to the stage. The father was shouting for the boy, but the boy wasn't answering. The writer walked to the edge of the stage, cupped his hands around his mouth, and screamed Audrey's name. And Audrey, where was she? No way of telling, for sure. It couldn't see through her eyes as it saw through the eyes of the lesser creatures. She had gone after the boy, certainly. Or had she already found him? It thought not. Not yet, anyway. That it would have sensed. It pounded one hand against Ellen's thigh in anxiety and frustration, leaving an instant bruise like a rotten place on the skin of an apple, then shifted focus once more. No, it saw. They were not all on stage. The prismatic quality of what it was seeing had misled it. Mary was still with old Tom. If Ellen could get to her while the others were preoccupied with Audrey and David, it might solve all sorts of problems later on. It didn't need her now. This current body was still serviceable and would continue so for a while. But it wouldn't do to have it fail at a crucial moment. It would be better, safer, if... The image that came was of a spider web with many silk-wrapped flies dangling from it, flies that were drugged but not dead. "Emergency rations," the old one whispered in Ellen Carver's voice, in Ellen Carver's language. "Knick-knack, paddywhack, give the dog a bone." And Mary's disappearance would demoralize the rest, take away any confidence they might have gained from escaping, finding shelter, and killing the cougar. It had thought they might manage that last. They were armed, after all, and the cougar was a physical being, Sark and Soma and Numa, not some goblin from the metaphysical wastes. But who could have imagined that pretentious old windbag doing it? He called the other one on a phone he had. You didn't guess that, either. You didn't know until the yellow truck came. Yes, and missing the phone had been a lapse, something right in the front of Marinville's mind that it should have picked up easily. But it didn't hold that against itself. At that point, its main goals had been to get the old fool jugged and replace Entragian's body before it could fall apart completely. It had been sorry to lose Entragian, too. Entragian had been strong. If it meant to take Mary, there would never be a better time than now. And perhaps while it did that, Audrey would find the boy and kill him. That would be wonderful. No worries then. No sneaking around. It could replace Ellen with Mary and pick the rest off at its leisure. And later, when its current and limited supply of bodies ran out, snatch more travelers from the highway? Perhaps. And when people, curious people, came to town to see what the hell was going on in desperation, what then? It would cross that bridge when it got to the river. It had little memory and even less interest in the future. For now, getting Mary up to China Pit would be enough. Tack went down the steps of the municipal building, glanced at the police car, then crossed the street on foot. No driving, not for this errand. Once it reached the far sidewalk, it began to run in long strides, sand spurting up from beneath sneakers which had been sprung out to the sides by feet which were now too big for them. 2. On stage, Audrey could hear them still calling David's name, and hers. Soon they would spread out and begin to search. They had guns, which made them dangerous. The idea of being killed didn't bother her. Not much, anyway. Not as it had at first. But the idea that it might happen before she was able to kill the boy did. To the cougar, the voice of the thing from the earth had been like a fishhook. In Audrey Weiler's mind, it was like an acid-coated snake, winding its way into her, melting the personality of the woman who had been here before it, even as it enfolded her. This melting sensation was extremely pleasant, like eating some sweet, soft food. It hadn't been at first. At first, it had been dismaying, like being overwhelmed by a fever. But as she collected more of the cantas, like a child participating in a scavenger hunt, that feeling had passed. Now she only cared about finding the boy. Tack, the unformed one, did not dare approach him, so she must do it in Tack's place. At the top of the stairs, the woman who had been 5'7" on the day Tom Billingsley had first glimpsed her stopped, looking around. She should have been able to see nothing. There was only one window, and the only light that fell through its filthy panes came from the blinker and a single weak street lamp in front of Bud Suds. But her vision had improved greatly with each canta she had found or been given. Now she had almost the vision of a cat, and the littered hallway was no mystery to her. The people who had hung out in this part of the building had been far less neatness-minded than Billingsley and his crew. They had smashed their bottles in the corners instead of collecting them, and instead of fantasy fish or smoke-breathing horses, the walls were decorated with broad magic marker pictographs. One of these, as primitive as any cave drawing, showed a horned and misshapen child hanging from a gigantic breast. Beneath it was scrawled a little couplet. "Little bitty baby Smitty, I seen you bite your mommy's titty." Paper trash, fast food sacks, candy wrappers, potato chip bags, empty cigarette packs, and condom envelopes had drifted along both sides of the hall. A used rubber hung from the knob of the door marked "Manager," pasted there in its own long-dried fluids like a dead snail. The door to the manager's office was on her right. Across from it was one marked "Janitor." Up ahead on the left was another door, this one unmarked, and then an arch with a word written on it in ancient black paint half flaked away. Even her eyes couldn't make out what the word was, at least from this distance, but a step or two closer and it came clear. Balcony. The archway had been boarded up, but at some point the boards had been pulled away and heaped to either side of it. Hanging from the top of the arch was a mostly deflated sex doll with blonde Arnell hair, a red-ringed hole of a mouth, and a bald, rudimentary vagina. There was a noose around its neck, the coils dark with age. Also around its neck, hanging against the doll's sagging plastic bosom, was a hand-lettered sign which looked as if it might have been made by a hard-working first grader. It was decorated with a red-eyed skull and crossbones at the top. "Don't come out here," it said. "Ready to fall down. I'm serious." Across from the balcony was an alcove which had once probably held a snack bar. At the far end of the hall were more steps going up into darkness. To the projectionist's booth, she assumed. Audrey went to the door marked "Manager," grasped the knob, and leaned her brow against the wood. Outside, the wind moaned like a dying thing. "David?" she asked gently. She paused, listened. "David, do you hear me? It's Audrey, David. Audrey Weiler. I want to help you." No answer. She opened the door and saw an empty room with an ancient poster for Bonnie and Clyde on the wall and a torn mattress on the floor. In the same magic marker, someone had written, "I'm a midnight creeper, all-day sleeper," below the poster. She tried the janitor's cubby next. It wasn't much bigger than a closet and completely empty. The unmarked door gave on a room that had probably once been a supply closet. Her nose, keener now, like her eyesight, picked up the aroma of long-ago popcorn. There were a lot of dead flies and a fair scattering of mouse shit, but nothing else. She went to the archway, swept aside the dangling dolly with her forearm, and peered out. She couldn't see the stage from back here, just the top half of the screen. The skinny girl was still yelling for David, but the others were silent. That might not mean anything, but she didn't like not knowing where they were. Audrey decided that the sign around the dolly's neck was probably a true warning. The seats had been taken out, making it easy to see the way the balcony floor heaved and twisted. It made her think of a poem she'd read in college, something about a painted ship on a painted ocean. If the brat wasn't out on the balcony, he was somewhere else, somewhere close. He couldn't have gone far. And he wasn't on the balcony, that much was for sure. With the seats gone, there was nowhere to hide, not so much as a drape or a velvet swag on the wall. Audrey dropped the arm which had been holding the half-deflated doll aside. It swung back and forth, the noose around its neck making a slow rubbing sound. Its blank eyes stared at Audrey. Its hole of a mouth with only one purpose, seemed to leer at her, to laugh at her. "Look at what you're doing," Frida Fuck Dolly seemed to be saying. "You were going to become the most highly paid woman geologist in the country, own your own consulting firm by the time you were 35, maybe win the Nobel Prize by the time you were 50. Weren't those the dreams? The Devonian-era scholar, the summa cum laude whose paper on tectonic plates was published in Geology Review, is chasing after little boys in crumbling old movie theaters. And no ordinary little boy, either. He's special, the way you always assumed you were special. And if you do find him, Aud, what then? He's strong. She grabbed the hangman's noose and yanked hard, snapping the old rope and pulling out a pretty country fair bunch of Arnell hair at the same time. The doll landed face down at Audrey's feet, and she drop-kicked it onto the balcony. It floated high, then settled. Not stronger than Tack, she thought. I don't care what he is, he's not stronger than Tack. Not stronger than the Cantaz, either. It's our town now. Never mind the past and the dreams of the past. This is the present, and it's sweet. Sweet to kill, to take, to own. Sweet to rule, even in the desert. The boy is just a boy. The others are only food. Tack is here now, and he speaks with the voice of the older age, with the voice of the unformed. She looked up the hall toward the stairs. She nodded, her right hand slipping into the pocket of her dress to touch the things that were there, to fondle them against her thigh. He was in the projection booth. There was a big padlock hanging on the door which led into the basement, so where else could he be? Him in tow, she whispered, starting forward. Her eyes were wide, the fingers of her right hand moving ceaselessly in the pocket of her dress. From beneath them came small, stony clicking sounds. 3. The kids who partied hardy upstairs in the American West until the fire escape fell down had been slobs, but they had mostly used the hall and the manager's office for their revels. The other rooms were relatively untouched, and the projectionist's little suite, the booth, the office cubicle, the closet-sized toilet stall, was almost exactly as it had been on the day in 1979 when five cigarette-smoking men from Nevada Sunlight Entertainment had come in, dismantled the carbon filament projectors, and taken them to Reno, where they still languished in a warehouse filled with similar equipment, like fallen idols. David was on his knees, head down, eyes closed, hands pressed together in front of his chin. The dusty linoleum beneath him was lighter than that which surrounded him. Straight ahead was a second lighter rectangle. It was here that the old projectors, clattery, baking-hot dinosaurs that raised the temperature in this room as high as 120 degrees on some summer nights, had stood. To his left were the cutouts through which they had shown their swords of light and projected their larger-than-life shadows. Gregory Peck and Kirk Douglas, Sophia Loren and Jane Mansfield, a young Paul Newman hustling pool, an old but still vital Betty Davis torturing her wheelchair-bound sister. Dusty coils of film lay here and there on the floor like dead snakes. There were old stills and posters on the walls. One of the latter showed Marilyn Monroe standing on a subway grating and trying to hold down her flaring skirt. Beneath a hand-drawn arrow pointing at her panties, some wit had printed, "Carefully insert shaft A in slot B, making sure tool is seated firmly and cannot slip out." There was an odd decayed smell in here, not quite mildew, not quite dry rot either. It smelled curdled, like something that had gone spectacularly bad before finally drying up. David didn't notice the smell any more than he heard Audrey softly calling his name from the hall which ran past the balcony. He had come here when the others had run to Billingsley. Even Audrey had gone as far as stage left at first, perhaps to make sure they were all going down the hall. Because he had been nearly overwhelmed by a need to pray, he had an idea that this time it would just be a matter of getting to some place quiet and opening the door. This time God wanted to talk to him, not the other way around. And this was a good place to do it. Pray in your closet and not in the street, the Bible said, and David thought that was excellent advice. Now that he had a closed door between him and the rest of them, he could open the one inside him. He wasn't afraid of being observed by spiders or snakes or rats. If God wanted this to be a private meeting, it would be a private meeting. The woman Steve and Cynthia had found was the real problem. She, for some reason, made him nervous, and he had a feeling she felt the same about him. He had wanted to get away from her, so he had slipped over the edge of the stage and run up the center aisle. He was under the sagging balcony and into the lobby before Audrey turned back from the stage left side of the movie screen, looking for him. From the lobby, he had come up to the second floor, and then had simply let some interior compass, or maybe it was Reverend Martin's still, small voice, lead him up here. He had walked across the room, barely seeing the old curls of film and the remaining posters, barely smelling the odor which might or might not have been celluloid fantasies stewed by the desert sun until they fell apart. He had stopped on this patch of linoleum, considering for a moment the large holes at the corners of the lighter rectangle shapes, holes where the king bolts which held the projector firmly in place had once gone. They reminded him, "I see holes like eyes," of something, something which fluttered briefly in his mind and then was gone. False memory, real memory, intuition, all of the above, none of the above. He hadn't known, hadn't really cared. His priority then had been to get in touch with God, if he could. He had never needed to more than now. "Yes," Reverend Martin said calmly inside his head. "And this is where your work is supposed to pay off. You keep in touch with God when the cupboard's full, so you can reach out to Him when it's empty. How many times did I tell you that last winter and this spring?" A lot. He just hoped that Martin, who drank more than he should and maybe couldn't be entirely trusted, had been telling the truth instead of just mouthing what David's dad called the company line. He hoped that with all his mind and heart, because there were other gods in desperation. He was sure of it. He began his prayer as he always did, not aloud but in his mind, sending words out in clear, even pulses of thought. "See in me, God, be in me, and speak in me if you mean to, if it's your will." As always at these times when he felt really in need of God, the front of his mind was serene, but the deeper part, where faith did constant battle with doubt, was terrified that there would be no answer. The problem was simple enough. Even now, after all his reading and praying and instruction, even after what had happened to his friend, he doubted God's existence. Had God used him, David Carver, to save Brian Ross's life? Why would God do a wild and crazy thing like that? Wasn't it more likely that what Dr. Wasluski had called a clinical miracle and what David himself had thought of as an answered prayer had actually been nothing more than a clinical coincidence? People could make shadows that looked like animals, but they were still only shadows, minor tricks of light and projection. Wasn't it likely that God was the same kind of thing, just another legendary shadow? David closed his eyes tighter, concentrating on the mantra and trying to clear his mind. "See in me, be in me, speak in me if it's your will." And a kind of darkness came down. It was like nothing he had ever known or experienced before. He sagged sideways against the wall between two of the projection cutouts, eyes rolling up to whites, hands falling into his lap. A low, guttural sound came from his throat. It was followed by sleep talk, which perhaps only David's mother could have understood. "Shit," he muttered. "The mummy's after us." Then he fell silent, leaning against the wall, a silver runner of drool, almost as fine as a spider's thread, slipping from one corner of what was, essentially, still a child's mouth. Outside the door, which he had shut in order to be alone with his God, there had once been a bolt on it, but that was long gone. Approaching footsteps could now be heard. They stopped outside the door. There was a long, listening pause, and then the knob turned. The door opened. Audrey Weiler stood there. Her eyes widened when they happened on the unconscious boy. She came into the fuggy little room, closed the door behind her, and looked for something, anything, to tilt and prop under the knob. A board, a chair. It wouldn't hold them off for long if they came up here, but even a thin margin might mean the difference between success and failure at this stage. But there was nothing. "Fuck," she whispered. She looked at the boy, realizing without much surprise that she was afraid of him, afraid even to go near him. "Tak-a-wan," the voice in her head. "Tak-a-wan," this time out of her mouth, a scent, both helpless and heartfelt. She went down the two steps into the projection booth proper and crossed, wincing at each gritting step, to where David leaned on his knees against the wall with the cutouts in it. She kept expecting his eyes to fly open, eyes that would be filled with an electric blue power. The right hand in her pocket squeezed the cantars together once more, drawing strength, then, reluctantly, left them. She dropped to her own knees in front of David, her cold and shaking fingers clasped before her. How ugly he was! And the smell coming from him was even more offensive to her. Of course she had stayed away from him. He looked like a gorgon and stank like a stew of spoiled meat and sour milk. "Pray boy," she said. "Ugly little pray boy." Her voice had changed into something that was neither male nor female. Black shapes had begun to move vaguely beneath the skin of her cheeks and forehead, like the beating, membranous wings of small insects. "Here's what I should have done the first time I saw your toad's face." Audrey's hands, strong and tanned, chipped here and there with scabs from her work, settled around David Carver's throat. His eyelids fluttered when those hands shut off his windpipe and stopped his breath. But just once. Just once. 4. "Why'd you stop?" Steve asked. He stood in the center of the improbable onstage living room beside the elegant old wet bar from the Circle Ranch. His strongest wish at that moment was for a fresh shirt. All day he had been baking. To call the Ryder van's air conditioning substandard was actually to be charitable. But now he was freezing. The water Cynthia was dabbing onto the punctures in his shoulders ran down his back in chill streams. At least he'd been able to talk her out of using Billingsley's whiskey to clean his wounds, like a dance hall girl fixing up a cowpoke in an old movie. "I thought I saw something," Cynthia spoke in a low voice. "Wanted to put it at?" "Very funny." She raised her voice to a shout. "David? David!" They were alone on stage. Steve had wanted to help Marinville and Carver look for the kid, but Cynthia had insisted on washing out what she called the holes in your hide first. The two men had disappeared into the lobby. Marinville had a new spring in his step, and the way he carried his gun made Steve think of another kind of old movie, the kind where the grizzled but heroic white hunter slogs through a thousand jungle perils and finally succeeds in plucking an emerald as big as a doorknob from the forehead of an idol watching over a lost city. "What? What did you see?" "I don't really know. It was weird, up on the balcony. For a minute I thought it was, you'll laugh, a floating body." Suddenly, something in him changed. It wasn't like a light going on. It was more as if one had been turned out. He forgot about the stinging of the wounds in his shoulders, but all at once his back was colder than ever. almost cold enough to start him shivering. For the second time that day, he remembered being a teenager in Lubbock, and how the whole world seemed to go still and deadly before the benders arrived from the plains, dragging their sometimes deadly skirts of hail and wind. "I'm not laughing," he said. "Let's go on up there." It was probably just a shadow. I don't think so.
"Steve, you okay?"
"No, I feel like I did when we came into town." She looked at him, alarmed.
"Okay, but we don't have a gun."
"Fuck that." He grabbed her arm. His eyes were wide, his mouth pinched. "Now, Christ, something is really wrong. Can't you feel it?"
"I might feel something. Should I get Mary? She's back with Billingsley."
"No time. Come or stay." He off stage, stumbled, grabbed a seat in the front row to steady himself, then ran up the center aisle. When he got to its head, Cynthia was right behind him, once again not even out of breath. The chick could motor. You had to give her that. The boss was just coming out of the box office, Ralph Carver behind him. "We've been looking out at the street," Johnny said. "The storm is definitely..."
"Steve? What's wrong?"
Without answering, Steve looked around, spotted the stairs, and pelted up them. Part of him was still amazed at the speed with which this feeling of urgency had grabbed hold. Most of him was just scared. "David! David, answer if you can hear me." Nothing. A grim, trash-lined hallway leading past what were probably the old balcony and a snack bar alcove. Narrow stairs going farther up at the far end. No one here. Yet he had a clear sense that there had been, and only a short time ago. "David!" he shouted.
"Steve? Mr. Ames?"
It was Carver. He sounded almost as scared as Steve felt.
"What's wrong? Has something happened to my son?"
"I don't know." Cynthia ducked under Steve's arm and hurried down the hallway to the balcony entrance. Steve went after her. A frayed length of rope was hanging down from the top of the arch, still swaying a little.
"Look!"
Cynthia pointed. At first, Steve thought the thing lying out there was a corpse, then registered the hair for what it was, some kind of synthetic. A doll, one with a noose around its neck. "Is this what you saw?" he asked her.
"Yes. Someone could have ripped it down and then maybe drop-kicked it."
The face she turned up to his was drawn and tense. In a voice almost too low to hear, she whispered,
"God, Steve, I don't like this."
Steve took a step back, glanced left. The boss and David's father looked at him anxiously, clutching their weapons against their chests, then looked right. "There," his heart whispered. Or perhaps it was his nose, picking up some lingering residue of opium, that whispered. "Up there must be the projection booth." He ran for it, Cynthia once more on his heels. He went up the narrow flight of stairs and was groping for the knob in the dimness when she grabbed the back of his pants to hold him where he was.
"The kid had a pistol. If she's in there with him, she could have it now. Be careful, Steve."
"David!" Carver bawled. "David, are you okay?" Steve thought of telling Cynthia there was no time to be careful, that that time had passed when they lost track of David in the first place. But there was no time to talk, either. He turned the knob and shoved the door hard with his shoulder, expecting to encounter either a lock or some other resistance, but there was none. The door flew open. He flew into the room after it. Across from him, against the wall with the projection slots cut into it, were David and Audrey. David's eyes were half open, but only their bulging whites showed. His face was a horrible corpse color, still greenish from the soap, but mostly gray. There were growing lavender patches beneath his eyes and high up on his cheekbones. His hands drummed spastically on the thighs of his jeans. He was making a soft choking sound. Audrey's right hand was clamped around his throat, her thumb buried deep in the soft flesh beneath his jaw on the right, the fingers digging in on the left.
Her formerly pretty face was contorted in an expression of hate and rage beyond anything Steve had ever seen in his life. It seemed to have actually darkened her skin somehow. In her left hand, she held the .45 revolver David had used to shoot the coyote. She fired it 3 times, and then it clicked empty. The 2-step drop into the projection booth almost certainly saved Steve at least one more hole in his already perforated hide, and might have saved his life. He fell forward like a man who has misjudged the number of stairs in a flight, and all 3 bullets went over his head. One thudded into the door jamb to Cynthia's right and showered splinters into her exotic hair. Audrey voiced a ululating scream of frustration. She threw the empty gun at Steve, who simultaneously ducked and raised one hand to bat it away. Then she turned back to the slumping boy and began to throttle him with both hands again, shaking him viciously back and forth like a doll. David's hands abruptly quit thrumming and simply lay on the legs of his jeans, as limp as dead starfish. 5.
Scared, Billingsley croaked.
It was, so far as Mary could tell, the last word he ever managed to say. His eyes looked up at her, both frantic and somehow confused. He tried to say something else and produced only a weak, gargling noise. Don't be scared, Tom. I'm right here.
Ah! Ah!
His eyes shifted from side to side, then came back to her face and seemed to freeze there. He took a deep breath, let it out, took a shallower one, let it out, and didn't take another. Tom? Nothing but a gust of wind and a hard rattle of sand from outside.
Tom!
She shook him. His head rolled limply from side to side, but his eyes remained fixed on hers in a way that gave her a chill. It was the way the eyes in some painted portraits seemed to stay on you, no matter where you were in the room. Somewhere, in this building, but sounding very far away just the same, she could hear Marinville's roadie yelling for David. The hippie girl was yelling, too. Mary supposed she should join them, help them search for David and Audrey if they were really lost, but she was reluctant to leave Tom until she was positive he was dead. She was pretty sure he was, yes, but it surely wasn't like on TV when you knew.
Help?
The voice, questioning and almost too weak to be heard over the slackening wind, still made Mary jump and cup a hand over her mouth to stifle a cry.
Help? Is anyone there? Please help me. I'm hurt.
A woman's voice. Ellen Carver's voice? Christ, was it? Although she had been in the company of David's mother for only a short time, Mary was sure she was right almost as soon as the idea occurred to her. She got to her feet, sparing another quick glance at poor Tom Billingsley's contorted face and staring eyes. Her legs had stiffened up on her, and she staggered for balance.
Please,
the voice outside moaned. It was in the alley which ran behind the theater.
Ellen, she asked, suddenly wishing she could throw her voice like a ventriloquist. It seemed she could trust nothing now, not even a hurt, scared woman. Ellen, is that you?
Mary.
Closer now.
Yes, it's me, Ellen. Is that Mary?
Mary opened her mouth, then closed it again. That was Ellen Carver out there. She knew it, but...
Is David all right? The woman out there in the dark asked, then swallowed back a sob. Please say that he is.
So far as I know, yes. Mary walked over to the broken window, skirting the pool of the cougar's blood, and looked out. It was Ellen Carver out there, and she didn't look good. She was slumped over her left arm, which she was holding against her breasts with her right. What Mary could see of her face was chalky white. Blood was trickling from her lower lip and from one nostril. She looked up at Mary with eyes so dark and desperate they seemed hardly human. How did you get away from Entragian? Mary asked.
I didn't. He just died. Bled everywhere and died. He was driving me in his car, taking me up to the mine, I think, when it happened. The car went off the road and turned over. One of the back doors popped open. Lucky for me, or I'd still be inside, caught like a bug in a can. I walked back to town.
What happened to your arm?
It's broken, Ellen said, hunching over it further. There was something unattractive about the pose. Ellen Carver looked like a troll in a fairy story, hunched protectively over a bag of ill-gotten gold. Can you help me get in? I want to see my husband, and I want to see David.
A part of Mary cried out in alarm at the idea, told her that something here did not compute. But when Ellen held up her good arm, and Mary saw the dirt and blood smeared on it, and the way it was trembling with exhaustion, her fundamentally kind heart overruled the wary lizard of instinct living far back in her brain. This woman had lost her young daughter to a madman, had been in a car wreck on the way to what would have most likely been her own murder, had suffered a broken arm, and walked through a howling windstorm back to a town filled mostly with corpses. And the first person she meets suddenly succumbs to a bad case of the Jim Jams and refuses to let her in? Mary thought. No way. And, perhaps absurdly, that's not how I was raised.
You can't come in this window. There's a lot of broken glass. Something, an animal, jumped through it. Go a little further along the back of the theater. You'll come to the ladies' room. That's better. There are even some boxes to stand on. I'll help you in, okay?
Yes. Thank you, Mary. Thank God I found you.
Ellen gave her a horrible, grimacing smile. Gratitude, shoe-licking humility, and what might have been terror all mixed together. And then shuffled on, head down, back bent. 12 hours ago, she had been Mrs. Suburban Wife Mom, on her way to a nice middle-class vacation in Lake Tahoe, where she had probably planned to wear her new resort clothes from Talbot's over her new underwear from Victoria's Secret. Daytime sun with the kids, nighttime sex with the comfy known partner, postcards home to the friends, having a great time, the air is so clean, wish you were here. Now she looked and acted like a refugee, a no-age war hag fleeing some ugly desert bloodbath. And Mary Jackson, that sweet little princess, votes Democratic, gives blood every 2 months, writes poetry, had actually considered leaving her out there to moan in the dark until she could consult with the men. And what did that mean? That she had been in the same war, Mary supposed. This was how you thought, how you behaved, when it happened to you. Except she wouldn't. Be damned if she would. Mary crossed the hall, listening for any further shouts from the theater. There were none. Then, just as she pushed open the ladies' room door, 3 gunshots rang out. They were muffled by walls and distance, but there was no doubt about what they were. Shouts followed them. Mary froze in place, pulled in 2 different directions with equal force. What decided her was the soft sound of weeping from beyond the unlatched ladies' room window.
Ellen, what is it? What's wrong?
I'm stupid, that's all. Stupid. I bumped my bad arm putting up another crate to stand on.
The woman outside the window, she was just a blur of shadow on the frosted glass, began sobbing harder.
Hold on, you'll be inside in a jiffy, Mary said, and hurried across the room.
She set aside the beer bottles Billingsley had put up on the window ledge and was lifting the hinged window, trying to think how best to help Ellen into the room without hurting her further, when she remembered what Billingsley had said about the cop, that he was taller.
Dear God, David's father had said, a look of thunderstruck understanding on his face. She's like Entragian? Like the cop?
Maybe she's got a broken arm, Mary thought coldly. Maybe she really does. On the other hand, hunching over like that was actually a very good way to disguise one's true height, wasn't it?
The lizard, which usually kept its place on the back wall of her brain, suddenly leaped forward, chirping in terror.
Mary decided to pull back, take a moment or two and think things over. But before she could, her arm was seized by a strong, hot hand.
Another one banged open the window, and all of Mary's strength ran out of her like water as she looked into the grinning face staring up at her.
It was Ellen's face, but the badge pinned below it.
"I see you're an organ donor.
Belong to Entragian."
It was Entragian. Collie Entragian somehow living in Ellen Carver's body.
"No!" she screamed, yanking backward, heedless of the pain as Ellen's fingernails punched into her arms and brought blood.
"No! Let go of me!"
"Not until I hear you sing Leaving on a Jet Plane, you cunt," the Ellen thing said,
and as it yanked Mary forward through the window it was still holding open, blood burst from both of Ellen's nostrils in a gush.
More blood trickled from Ellen's left eye like gummy tears.
"Oh, the dawn is breaking, it's early morn."
Mary had a confused sensation of flying toward the board fence on the other side of the lane.
"The taxi driver is blowing his horn."
She managed to get one blocking arm up, but not enough. She took most of the impact with her forehead and went to her knees, head ringing. She could feel warmth spreading over her lips and chin.
"Join the nosebleed club, babe," she thought, and staggered to her feet. "Already I'm so lonesome I could cry."
Mary took two large, lunging strides, and then the cop. She couldn't stop thinking of it as the cop, only now wearing a wig and falsies. Grabbed her by the shoulder, almost tearing one arm off her shirt as it whirled Mary around.
"Let go!"
Mary began, and then the Ellen thing clipped her on the point of the chin, a crisp and elementary blow that put out the lights. It caught Mary under the arms on her way down and pulled her close. When it felt Mary's breath on Ellen's skin, the faint anxiety which had been on Ellen's face cleared.
"Gosh, I love that song," it said, and slung Mary over her shoulder like a sack of grain. "It turns me all gushy inside. Tack!"
She disappeared around the corner with her burden. 5 minutes later, Collie Entragian's dusty caprice was once more on its way out to the China Pit, headlights cutting through the swirls of sand driven by the dying wind. As it drove past Harvey's small engine repair and the bodega beyond it, a thin blue-white sickle of moon appeared in the sky overhead.